After Pearl Harbor, the United States was desperate to get back into the war and hit the Japanese. President Franklin D. Roosevelt gave the green light to an ambitious plan to bomb Tokyo and show the Japanese that the U.S. had a long military reach and was undefeated. On the 18th of April 1942, that idea became a reality when 16 B-25 Mitchell medium bombers were launched from the aircraft carrier USS Hornet, several hundred miles from the Japanese mainland. Each of the planes was stripped of armament and most of its fixtures and fittings so that they could carry more fuel and bombs for what men in the Army believed would be a one-way mission. Led by Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle, each plane dumped 1 ton of bombs over Tokyo and other targets, and although the physical effects of the air raid were negligible, the psychological effect on the Japanese was astounding. The government had led its people to believe that the home islands were safe from enemy incursion, and the fact that so many American bombers had penetrated Japanese airspace and dropped bombs near the Imperial Palace was cause of great shame and loss of face. The Doolittle raid confirmed in the minds of the Japanese government, military, and public the vulnerability of Japan's cities. Even Tokyo was largely constructed of wood, and the small Doolittle attack showed how easy it would be to destroy Japan's infrastructure and economy through the use of air power. Harsh new laws would be promulgated, ordering the treatment of captured flyers to be the same as the treatment of war criminals. Coupled with the refusal of the Japanese government to ratify the 1929 Geneva Convention, which their diplomats had signed, the chances of surviving after being shot down over Japanese-occupied territory were slim at best for most Allied aircrew. The Japanese believed that such harsh treatment of Allied airmen would discourage enemy bombing raids upon its territory, since they believed that the Allied nations placed great store in the numbers of their own casualties and the manner of their men's treatment after capture. This was certainly true, but Japan's illegal treatment of prisoners did not prevent British, American, Australian, Dutch, and New Zealand aircraft from attacking targets across the empire. Doolittle's aircraft was supposed to fly 1,200 miles across the East China Sea to friendly air bases in Chinese-controlled territory on the mainland after striking Tokyo, but many ran out of fuel and crashed in Japanese-controlled areas. 64 American airmen bailed out over Chekiang in eastern China, and 8 were captured and turned over to the Kempei Tai, the Japanese military police. The remainder escaped to freedom with the assistance of Chinese guerrillas, and one B-25 landed in the Soviet Union, where the aircraft and its crew were interned for the duration. Those 8 Americans captured at Chekiang were cruelly tortured by the furious Kempei Tai, and the decision was taken at the highest levels to punish all Allied airmen who in future dared to attack Japanese targets. On the 13th of August 1942, the Japanese hurriedly sanctioned a new law making air raids on any territory controlled by the Japanese a war crime. Captured Allied airmen were to be denied prisoner of war status and indeed would face a military court-martial. "Death shall be the military punishment," read the Japanese order, "and shall be by shooting." Mitigating circumstances were occasionally allowed by the Japanese, and instead of a horrible death, some airmen were instead sentenced to inhuman imprisonments in circumstances of the greatest cruelty. Conveniently, the Japanese had ignored the fact that they had been the first modern power to use air attacks on populated areas when Japanese Navy seaplanes had bombed Shanghai in 1932, killing thousands of innocent civilians. The new regulation was in total violation of international law, as it meant that airmen faced death sentences for attacking viable industrial targets that supplied the Japanese war machine, and it was contrary to the expected treatment of captured enemy personnel. The results were predictable. The Kempei Tai was able to torture captured airmen and then court-martial them in spurious legal circumstances at show trials. Executions smelled distinctly of revenge killings. 3 of Doolittle's men suffered this fate when they were court-martialed and shot as war criminals by the Japanese. The Kempei Tai, however, was only just getting warmed up. The Japanese instituted one of the biggest war crimes in history throughout Chekiang and Kyansu province. Any village or town that was suspected of having harbored downed American flyers was razed to the ground and its inhabitants massacred. By mid-August 1942, the Japanese had murdered 250,000 men, women, and children. It was an appallingly high price to pay for what had been a propaganda attack on the Japanese mainland, almost completely devoid of military results. On the 28th of July 1942, the commander of the China Expeditionary Army, General Shunroku Hata, ordered that all US airmen currently held in Japanese custody be put on trial as war criminals. This was a retroactive order, as they were already in prison in China. The Kempei Tai had already beaten and tortured these men so thoroughly that when the Americans were brought to court, most were in no fit state even to stand and answer the charge. They were offered no defense representation whatsoever, and were duly found guilty of war crimes. Three of them were sentenced to death, while the other five were given life imprisonment. The death sentences were carried out in October 1942. Following Doolittle's daring raid, the Japanese home islands were to remain impervious to attack until late in the war. The Americans lacked an aircraft with the range to reach targets in Japan until they had captured bases closer to the home islands. The introduction of the Boeing B-29 Superfortress and the capture of the Mariana Islands brought Japan in range of regular air attack. From June 1944, Japan was bombed by B-29s, but these were low-intensity raids involving only a few dozen aircraft flying from bases in Chengdu in China. The raids were expensive to mount because all the supplies needed for the bases, aircraft, and personnel had to be flown into China from British India, and involved aircraft crossing the formidable hump, as the pilots soon christened the Himalayas. The first B-29 raid on Japan was flown from Chengdu on the 15th of June 1944, when 47 superfortresses attacked a huge iron and steel works at Yawata. Once the Mariana Islands had been captured by American amphibious forces, huge numbers of B-29s were sent to five new bases. They were located on the islands of Tinian, Saipan, and Guam. Japanese industry could now be systematically reduced and cities and towns razed. These islands were easily supplied by ship, unlike the air bases in Free China. The first combat mission against Japan was launched from Saipan on the 24th of November 1944, when 111 B-29s attacked Tokyo. Thereafter, even more intense raids were launched until the end of the war, resulting in an inferno of destruction and loss of life not witnessed before or since in the history of air warfare. For Allied aircrew shot down over Japanese-occupied territory or the home islands after the Doolittle raid in April 1942 and the beginning of the B-29 raids, the prospects of surviving were extremely dim indeed. And some of the stories of those who were spared death but instead imprisoned by the Kempei Tai are among the true untold stories of the Second World War. People often forget that the strategic bombing campaign against Japan cost the lives of many Americans, and the Japanese air defences, though nowhere near as good as the German Luftwaffe, were not idle in trying to knock B-29s out of the skies by any and every means to hand. Fire was the key to defeating Japan. Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, architect of the Pearl Harbor attack in 1941, had little faith in the ability of the home islands to stand up to a modern war. In 1939, he tried to warn his people, commenting that Japanese cities, being made of wood and paper, would burn very easily. The army talks big, but if war came and there were large-scale air raids, there's no telling what would happen. Incendiary raids meant the effective destruction of Japanese cities, along with the deaths of huge numbers of civilians. The first great firebombing raid on Tokyo was launched on the night of the 23rd to 24th of February 1945, when 174 B-29s destroyed 1 square mile of the city. On the night of the 9th to 10th of March, 334 superfortresses started a huge firestorm that consumed 16 square miles of Tokyo and killed over 100,000 people. Over the following weeks, 1,600 sorties against Japan's six principal cities, Tokyo, Nagoya, Kobe, Osaka, Yokohama, and Kawasaki, devastated over 40% of the urban area. A fleet of 600 B-29s flattened dozens of smaller cities over the coming months. Every Japanese city except Kyoto was hit, the damage varying in scale from 20 to 30% of the urban area destroyed to almost total eradication of the settlement. For example, Toyama, 99% destroyed, Fukui, 86%, Tokushima, 85.2%, and Fukuyama, 80.9%. Although American aircraft dropped leaflets on cities targeted for destruction in advance of a raid urging citizens to escape, civilian casualties were massive, and the hatred of the Japanese people for American flyers was intense and understandable. On the night of the 24th to 25th of May 1945, Tokyo burned. The city glowed orange in the darkness, flames leaping and twisting themselves into great columns of fire that stretched up into the smoke-blackened sky. The temperature was tremendous. A searing heat whipped into a howling wind that destroyed whole city blocks in an instant, turning people into blazing torches that struggled helplessly for a moment before collapsing into blackened shapes that melted into the boiling pavements. Above the city roared huge silver aircraft, their bomb bay doors hanging open like obscene gashes as more incendiary and napalm bombs tumbled to earth. The drone of the aerial engines, a constant background refrain to the carnage below. At the Imperial Palace complex, Emperor Hirohito and his family sat stiff-backed on chairs inside the protective concrete shell of an air raid shelter, deep underground, listening to their capital being gutted. The Emperor's eyes darting nervously towards the dusty ceiling, while thump followed thump as bombs crawled their way towards his home. Not far from the palace, voices were raised in terror, some in Japanese and some in English. Guards ran around a large jail complex, bellowing orders in Japanese, jangling keys in locks and herding prisoners towards air raid shelters as they cast terrified glances over their shoulders at the huge firestorm bearing down upon them. One block of the jail was in an uproar. White faces, many with blackened eyes or split lips, clamoured at the cell windows and doors, calling, screaming, and pleading in English to be released before it was too late. The commandant, his orders clear, had released some 450 of his fellow countrymen held as military prisoners in the jail. He glanced back contemptuously at the white men screaming for mercy and hurried his remaining staff into the shelters as the first incendiaries began bursting across the jail. He felt no sympathy for the white prisoners, and had callously abandoned them to a fate he believed they richly deserved. The white prisoners, 62 of them, were all American airmen captured when their B-29s had been forced down over the Tokyo area during previous raids. They had been beaten, humiliated, and denied medical treatment since capture, and were now left to perish at the hands of their comrades high above, raining fire and death on the city as they themselves had done before. The Japanese hated the American flyers more than any of their tens of thousands of brutalized prisoners spanning the length and breadth of their slave empire. For the B-29s brought America's revenge to the very shores of the sacred home islands, and even threatened the life of the God Emperor himself. When the fires abated a few hours later, the guards emerged from their bunkers and surveyed the scene before them. The jail was severely damaged, with many small fires still burning in the early morning haze. The block where the Americans were held was also a ruin, but some of the smoke-blackened prisoners were miraculously still alive. Stretching away in all directions was a barren, smouldering ruin of a city, unrecognizable and uninhabitable. The officers and their guards felt their hatred intensify against the Americans who had committed this outrage, an impotent anger that they could no longer militarily express against the high-flying B-29s. Seizing their rifles and fixing their bayonets, the infuriated Japanese guards dashed in among the dead and dying Americans and began to smash skulls, break arms and legs, and stab the bodies over and over again until all of them were dead. The greatest air raid of the war so far was over. A force of 558 B-29s had leveled half of the city of Tokyo, 56.3 square miles reduced to rubble, ash, and twisted metal. It was the third gigantic air attack on Japan's capital and signaled that the final endgame for the Japanese had arrived. A few more of these raids and Japan would be reduced to a smoking ruin. Over 1 million Japanese were now homeless in Tokyo and over 100,000 lay dead. The remaining city hospitals were overwhelmed with 40,000 injured. 14 wrecked B-29s lay among this carnage like giant beached whales, a small price for the Americans to pay for so great a result. But the Japanese would not surrender. They determined to fight even harder for their emperor and to exact a terrible toll in blood from the hated Allied nations as the front line crept ever closer to the Japanese homeland. The cold-blooded murder of the American flyers in Tokyo that morning by the Kempei Tai was part of the hardening of the Japanese spirit. Many believed that they would not leave any of their prisoners alive to be liberated should they lose the war. At Omori prison camp on the outskirts of Tokyo, the American prisoners held there were spared the wrath of the Japanese and survived the war to be liberated. They were all aircrew and had been shot down either over Japan or earlier on in the war over the occupied territories and transported to Omori as slave laborers. Among them was 39-year-old Colonel Richard T. King, commanding officer of the 500th Bombardment Group, who had been shot down over Tokyo on the 3rd of December 1944, and 22-year-old Lieutenant Raymond Hap Halloran, a B-29 navigator who had bailed out over Tokyo on the 27th of January 1945. Their stories are typical of the brutalization Allied airmen were subjected to, the state of constant tension and fear they felt as prisoners of the Kempei Tai. They had all feared falling into enemy hands, but they were also confident of their aircraft and the righteousness of their mission. "We were proud of our assignment as B-29 crew members," said Halloran. "Had no personal concerns. War at 32,000 feet is impersonal." Halloran was about to discover that war at ground level was to prove considerably more personal. Colonel King was flight commander of a 12-aircraft formation of B-29s on the 3rd of December 1944 at 32,000 feet over Tokyo. His aircraft, which he piloted, was nicknamed Rosalie Rocket. Their mission was to attack an aircraft engine plant, and they were engaged by Japanese fighters shortly after dropping their bombs. "Although we shot down some of the fighters, they hit our left inboard gasoline tank so seriously that it sprayed gasoline all over the aircraft and the entire ship began to burn," recalled King. "By the time the ship had lost altitude to 29,000 feet, I bailed out. At that time, I did not realize that I was injured in any way. Immediately after bailing out, I counted at least 8 and possibly 9 chutes as I floated earthward myself," he said. A B-29 had a crew of 11. King landed in an open field and cut the shroud lines to his parachute canopy. He discovered that he had been burned on one leg and across his face. "Since Japanese fighters were diving down directly over the field and it seemed they might be looking for me, I walked over under the trees at one side of the field and waited there a few moments," he said. A quick inventory showed that his Colt 45 pistol had been torn off when he jumped, so he was unarmed and in very hostile territory. Hap Halloran was only on his fourth mission on the 27th of January 1945, when his squadron of B-29s was attacked by a pair of Japanese fighters. Halloran's aircraft, Rover Boys Express, was hit. "Suddenly we were trailing smoke and fire with a full load of bombs and half our fuel," recalled Halloran. "We fell below and behind the rest of the B-29s in our squadron. There was nothing they could do to help us. It was a sad feeling." Fire from the Japanese fighters had ripped through the Superfortress's fuselage and shot out the electrical controls and the intercom system. The pilot controlled the rudder and control surfaces of the aircraft through electrical cables, and the turret-mounted defensive armament was also electrically controlled. The B-29 was going to crash, so the only option was to dump the bombs and get the crew of 11 out through the bomb bay. As we bailed out through the bomb bay, my feet, hands and face froze, said Halloran. The B-29 was pressurized and was flying at 32,000 feet when it was hit. The sudden drop in temperature had been dramatic, from a pleasant 70 degrees to minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit, a change of 127 degrees in less than a second. Halloran was in free fall over Japan. I didn't want to let my silk out too fast and fell free to somewhere between 3 and 4,000 feet over Chiba Prefecture, east of Tokyo. He was concerned lest roving Japanese fighters machine gun him as he floated helplessly beneath his parachute canopy, and I wanted to get out of the extreme cold and rarefied air to warmer air near the ground. Halloran popped his chute, but three Japanese fighters headed directly for me as I hung helpless in the sky. They came in very close, throttled back, and circled me in a counterclockwise direction, very close in. Two left after the initial circling. The third plane returned for a second pass, very close in. I feared the worst. He throttled back, was very close in just below me. I raised my hands over my head. I was frightened. The pilot was very visible to me. At this point, the Japanese pilot did something quite extraordinary. He saluted me and pulled off, said Halloran. As the young American officer continued drifting down towards Earth, he could see Japanese civilians following his descent on the ground. A large group was gathering, and an ugly reception committee was waiting for him when Halloran landed heavily in a residential area east of Tokyo. It was the moment many American aircrew failed to survive, and being shot down and bailing out over Japan was one of the greatest fears faced by the flyers. As Halloran remarked to me, "Fears? Yes, sir, being shot down over Japan and captured." He believed that we would be killed by civilians or military. That many Americans expected death in Japanese hands was because it was logical. They hated us for good reason. We were destroying their country. They were starving. Colonel King also faced a hostile reception when a group of Japanese civilians found him in the countryside. They not only handcuffed me, but also bound me by my own shroud lines. Ironically, it was the Kempei Tai who actually saved Lieutenant Hap Halloran's life. As Halloran drifted closer to the ground, he could see the angry, upturned faces of local Japanese civilians and hear their excited screams. He could also see the many weapons they carried in their hands. "I felt helpless and feared the worst. I hit very hard in a strong wind," recalled Halloran. "The civilians followed the flow of my chute. They were extremely hostile and beat me with clubs, rods, rocks, and many other objects. I blacked out from the beatings. I felt I would die that afternoon on enemy soil." As soon as it was reported by Japanese air defences that enemy planes had been shot down and crewmen had been observed bailing out, Kempei Tai's squads were sent out in any available transport to track the white parachutes as they came to Earth and capture the airmen before enraged civilians killed them. Halloran was lucky, for a group of Kempei Tai soldiers quickly arrived on the scene and wedged themselves between the prone Halloran and the mob, ordering them back. The Kempei Tai knew the value of enemy airmen and the military intelligence they could torture out of them before they were court-martialed and executed or imprisoned under the instructions of the 13th of August 1942. For some Americans, the Kempei Tai arrived just in the nick of time as they were only seconds away from death. Lieutenant Delbart W. Miller of the 40th Bombardment Group was shot down on the 26th of May 1945 over Tokyo. Shortly after he landed, a group of Japanese civilians had beaten him and thrown a rope noose around his neck and were about to lynch him from the nearest lamppost when the Kempei Tai intervened. Colonel Richard King was not beaten by the crowd of civilians who captured him, but instead they marched him to the local police station, where I waited for 2 hours until two Japanese soldiers came to pick me up, he said. King and another downed airman, Colonel Byron Brug from Wing Headquarters, were blindfolded, loaded onto a truck, and driven into central Tokyo. I was tied and thrown into a coal truck and taken to a briefing room at a fighter base where the beatings continued, recalled Lieutenant Halloran. He was then transferred to a Kempeitai prison close to the imperial palace, where he was extensively maltreated. "They wanted to know all about the B-29 aircraft," said Halloran. "It was a charade. One day they showed me a large blueprint of the aircraft, and I found out that they knew more about the technical aspects of the plane than I did." All bomber crews flying missions over Japan had been told to cooperate with the Japanese if they fell into enemy hands. Halloran and his crew were briefed 1 week before their final mission by a U.S. Marine Corps officer from Washington, D.C., who instructed them to forget earlier briefings regarding capture and interrogation and tell them answers to all questions, as the standard name, rank, and serial number routine only resulted in instant death when captured. The Japanese wanted to know all about Saipan, the island base the Americans used to launch B-29 raids on Japan. Saipan had a large Japanese population and had been captured after fierce fighting with Japanese forces. "They would grill me about Saipan," said Halloran. "How many Japanese prisoners were held there? I told them I didn't know the difference between a Japanese and an islander. That was the wrong answer, and I would be knocked down again. I would tell them that I didn't see any Japanese after being accused of killing Japanese as they tried to surrender when the island fell in 1944. With that answer, I would be hit again. Well, maybe I saw a few, I would say, and then they would beat the hell out of me and say that their people would never surrender. It was a no-win situation." Colonel King had been subjected to a similar interrogation to Halloran several weeks before. The Japanese demanded his name, rank, and serial number, which he gave, as this was not in contravention of the Geneva Convention. However, they went on to request our home addresses and other information. When I asked why they wanted this information, they said they needed it so they could notify our families. This, of course, was never done. King was stripped, but some of his clothing was later returned to him. He was then subjected to a severe interrogation, as he put it, concerning Saipan. "When I answered many of their questions truthfully that I did not know, they attempted to force me to answer by slapping my face and other minor abuse." Lieutenant Halloran spent 67 days in Kempeitai custody, where he was kept in a horse stall in solitary confinement, was interrogated and beaten virtually every day, and was offered no medical treatment for his injuries. The last 2 days were truly bizarre. The Japanese took some American flyers to Ueno Zoo in Tokyo, where the men were stripped naked and in their filthy, bruised and bearded state placed into animal cages and displayed to the public. Members of the public filed past the cages, laughing and jeering at the prisoners. Even at the height of the firebombing campaign against German cities and industry in 1944-45, downed British and American aircrew were usually accorded prisoner of war status and treated well. There were cases where enraged mobs beat Allied airmen to death soon after they landed by parachute or strung them up from the nearest lamppost. But there was never this level of sadistic cruelty and denigration officially organized by the German authorities. Aircrew prisoners fell under the jurisdiction of the Luftwaffe, not the Gestapo, and they were treated as fellow professional airmen by their captors. One could only imagine the outcry among the British if the government had ordered downed Luftwaffe airmen to be publicly exhibited naked in cages at Regent's Park Zoo, even at the height of the Blitz. When Hap Halloran arrived at Omori Camp on the 1st of April 1945, he discovered 31 other flyers, including 5 members of the crew of the Rover Boys Express. By far the most prominent prisoner held at Omori was 33-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Gregory Pappy Boyington, a Sioux Indian and a decorated Marine Corps fighter ace with 26 confirmed aerial victories to his name. Boyington was one of the famous Flying Tigers, the American volunteer group that flew combat missions against the Japanese in China before the Pacific War began, and later commanded Marine Corps Squadron VMF 211, famously called the Black Sheep Squadron. Boyington had been shot down over Rabaul in New Britain during a massive dogfight with Japanese aircraft on the 3rd of January 1944, during which he had personally dispatched 3 enemy fighters. He bailed out into the sea and was picked up by a Japanese submarine and taken prisoner. Immediately after the war, Boyington was awarded the Medal of Honor and the Navy Cross by President Truman. Halloran got to know Boyington well during their imprisonment together, recalling that he had maintained a sparkle in his eyes and the look and mannerisms of a natural leader. Boyington was tough. He instilled confidence in us in a quiet way, and I knew I would be okay as long as Pappy was there. Even the Japanese were impressed to have such a famous prisoner. Boyington would give the Japanese guards demonstrations, the number of Japanese planes he had shot down. Strangely, most of his guards respected and sometimes applauded him. The end of the war in the Far East brought only more death to captive Allied aircrew. The city of Hiroshima was strictly off-limits for Allied bombers, even as a secondary target, because the Americans wanted it preserved intact to test the effectiveness of the atomic bomb against a fully populated and pristine Japanese city. Hiroshima was a major military base, the stated reason for its destruction by the Americans, and because it was one of the last major cities undamaged by the B-29 raids, its Kempeitai unit was fully operational and based at Hiroshima Castle. On the 28th of July 1945, a group of American B-24 liberators had attacked the huge Japanese naval base at Kurei with the aim of damaging or sinking the battleship Haruna at anchor in the harbour. Passing over Mount Futaba, the American aircraft drew considerable anti-aircraft fire and planes were hit. Ironically, although the bombers successfully sank the Haruna, the battleship's fuel tanks had been pumped dry, so the ship was already immobilized before the attack. The first B-24 to go down was nicknamed Taloa. Very few of the crew got clear of the stricken aircraft. A second plane was hit, but was able to fly to an island short of Okinawa, recalled Second Lieutenant Thomas Cartwright, piloting Lonesome Lady. Suddenly, Cartwright's plane was struck by flak and badly damaged. I did not realize how badly we were damaged and planned to head for the open sea, where there was hope that our naval seaplanes would spot us and pick us up if we ditched and survived, wrote Cartwright. We started losing altitude and the controls became less responsive, and I could not head out to sea. The plane flew back towards land on its own. With one engine on fire, Cartwright ordered his crew to jump for it. One crewman perished when his parachute failed to open, but the other seven made it safely to the ground, finding themselves spread out over several miles. All but one of the American flyers was quickly picked up by the local Kempeitai, though a Japanese civilian was shot dead by two of the Americans when he approached them with a rifle. The Americans were taken to Chugoku Military Police Headquarters in Hiroshima and roughly interrogated. At this stage of the war, American airmen were instructed to cooperate fully with their captors, in the hope of saving their lives, as the war appeared to be almost over. The Kempeitai did not believe most of what the airmen told them and continued to beat and torture them for information. In total, the Kempeitai picked up 15 Americans from Taloa and Lonesome Lady. The Kempeitai dispersed these men into individual cells at three locations around Hiroshima. On the morning of the 6th of August, two silver B-29 Superfortress bombers appeared above the untouched city of Hiroshima. One carried an atomic bomb, the other cameras to film what followed. At 8:16 a.m., nuclear destruction flattened most of Hiroshima, killing around 140,000 people. Most of the Americans in the city, including two U.S. Navy flyers, were vaporized. Evidence suggests that some survived the initial blast, only to be murdered by vengeful Kempeitai officers and local civilians. Two were probably dragged from their cells at Hiroshima Castle and clubbed to death in the grounds by the furious Kempeitai, while two others were tied to lampposts in the devastated city and stoned to death by mobs of disbelieving civilians. Lieutenant Cartwright survived and was taken to Tokyo for further interrogation about the new American wonder weapon, while tail gunner Wilbur Abel had managed to hide in the hills around Hiroshima when he had first landed by parachute and had thus avoided capture. The day after the atomic bombing, Abel gave himself up. The Kempeitai tortured him badly, but he did manage to survive the war along with Cartwright, one of only a handful of American airmen captured by the Kempeitai who did. One of the most horrific stories of World War II began with the shooting down of an American B-29 bomber on the 5th of May 1945. The B-29 of the 6th Bomb Squadron, 29th Bomb Group, was part of a 55-ship raid on Taichiri Airfield on Kyushu Island from Guam. Three American aircraft were down by the weak Japanese defences, including one piloted by First Lieutenant Marvin Watkins. A Japanese fighter actually rammed Watkins' huge plane, causing sufficient damage for him to give the order to the crew to bail out near the town of Taketa. Hitting the silk over Japan was about the last thing anyone wanted to do, as it was tantamount to a death sentence. As we saw in a previous episode, apart from torture and imprisonment, in one famous case, airmen from a downed American aircraft were displayed naked in cages at a city zoo for the amusement of locals. This assumed that the airman actually survived his first few minutes on Japanese soil. Japanese civilians routinely murdered downed aircrew, stabbing or beating them to death, or stringing them up from the nearest tree or lamppost. Those who were rescued quickly by the Kempei Tai, the much-feared Japanese military police, faced torture as the Japanese tried to extract military secrets and aircraft data from them. Aboard Watkins B-29, all 11 crewmen successfully exited the stricken machine and began to descend to Earth under their white parachutes. The crewmen were widely dispersed when they hit the ground, and their fates were wildly different. One American died before reaching the earth after another circling Japanese fighter used its wing to sever his parachute lines. Another landed safely, only to see a mob of baying villagers running towards him, armed with a variety of sharp farm implements and sticks. He quickly dragged out his Colt 45 pistol and began firing at them, carefully counting off each round. When he had fired all but one bullet, he calmly put the gun to his right temple and pulled the trigger. For a young and healthy man to have chosen so radical a solution as instant suicide gives one an idea of the fear of capture by the Japanese. Another American landed and was shot to death by another enraged crowd of Japanese civilians. The fate of one airman remains unsolved, while the B-29 skipper, First Lieutenant Watkins, landed safely and managed to avoid capture for 8 hours. The rest of his crew was quickly captured by Japanese Army and Kempei Tai troops, but not before being badly knocked about by the locals. Some had been stabbed. All were denied any medical treatment, and instead taken to a temporary POW center at Western Army Headquarters in Fukuoka. A handful of other American airmen shot down earlier were also imprisoned at the center. On the 17th of May, a truck took 8 of the American aircrew to the medical department of the prestigious Kyushu Imperial University in the city, the very institution that counted amongst its alumni none other than Dr. Shiro Ishii, the man who created and ran the infamous Unit 731, Japan's biological and chemical warfare center in Manchuria. First Lieutenant Watkins was not among them. As the commander of the aircraft and the senior officer who had been captured, the Kempei Tai shipped him off to Tokyo for a detailed interrogation that involved some torture. He survived the war. Those of his men left behind were turned over to the custody of the doctors and scientists at the university to use as they saw fit. It appears from the trial proceedings that a local Japanese colonel and a medical officer decided to release 8 Americans to Kyushu University for the express purpose of human experimentation. The Americans had absolutely no idea of what the Japanese were about to do to them. The 8 American POWs were used in a series of experiments, all of them fatal, overseen by senior Japanese civilian doctors at the university. Each airman was dissected whilst he was alive on a table that was usually used by medical students to dissect corpses. There was no debate among the doctors about whether to do the operations, recalled Dr. Toshio Tono, who as a young medical assistant took part in the vivisections in 1945. "That is what made it so strange," he said. Tono was so disgusted by what he had witnessed that he published an explosive book on the subject in Japan in the 1980s, against the wishes of his wartime colleagues. It was especially embarrassing as many of them still occupied senior teaching and research positions at the university. The Americans suffered terribly as the operations were conducted without the benefit of anesthetics. stomachs and hearts were opened up, and a study was made about survival, with part of the liver missing. Even a portion of the brain of one flyer was excised in order to test a technique for treating epilepsy. Sergeant Teddy Poncher, the first POW to be experimented upon, was used for a second experiment where his blood was removed and replaced with seawater to see if it would work as a substitute for the saline solution normally used as a blood volumizer in medical treatments. It did not, and Poncher died in agony. On the 17th of May 1945, two Americans were experimented upon. The 22nd of May, a further two. On the 25th, a single POW. And on the 2nd of June, three men. On the 3rd of June, the liver from the last victim was removed and preserved in preparation for a party that evening in the officers' hospital. According to witnesses, the liver was char-grilled and seasoned with soy sauce before being served as an appetizer to the assembled military and civilian guests. The remains of the American airman were preserved in the anatomy department of Kyushu Imperial University inside glass jars so that students could study them. After the Japanese surrender, and naturally in fear of prosecution for war crimes, the guilty doctors ordered the remains to be disposed of and all records of the experiments destroyed. Stories were quickly concocted to conceal the truth about what had happened to the eight Americans. But inevitably, news leaked out, and soon the American occupation authorities got wind of the story. The Japanese initially stated the airmen had perished during an air raid, but then they changed their story to suggest that the Americans had been conveniently incinerated during the atomic bombing of Hiroshima on the 6th of August 1945. An investigation by U.S. military intelligence and a wave of arrests followed, with a war crimes trial convened in Yokohama in March 1948. One of the surgeons who had vivisected the prisoners, Dr. Fumio Ishiyama, the chief of surgery at Kyushu University, committed suicide in jail before he stood trial, indicating his guilt. Eventually, 30 Japanese, some military and some civilian medical personnel, stood trial over the deaths of the eight Americans in Fukuoka. 23 were found guilty and sentenced. 5 were sentenced to death by hanging, 4 to life imprisonment, and the remaining 14 to shorter periods of detention. However, in the spirit of détente with Japan, because the nation had become a very useful ally for the United States during the early phase of the Cold War, particularly during the Korean War, all of the convicted were set free by 1958. None of those sentenced to hang ever did. The whole incident was gradually and effectively written out of history. Kyushu University was certainly very keen to expunge references to the 1945 atrocity from its official history. The 1992 edition of that weighty 700-page tome only includes one page concerning the vivisection experiments. But more recently, the university's medical museum created a display addressing the infamous dissections of U.S. prisoners during the war. It was only through the efforts of Dr. Tono, who published his damning book about the experiments, that this dark chapter in the history of a venerable academic institution has become more widely known. Today, a small memorial exists to the airmen where their B-29 fell to earth, alongside a similar memorial to the Japanese pilot who rammed his fighter into the big American bomber and killed himself in the process. That is at least some progress towards coming to terms with the horrific deeds of the past.